Welcome back to Curious Questions with me, Ricky Williams. And I am extra excited and extra curious to talk to today's guest. His name is Dr. Carl Hart. Dr. Carl Hart is a professor of neuroscience and psychology at Columbia University. He was the first tenured African-American professor in the sciences. So very, very impressive fella. But that's not exactly why I'm excited to talk to him. It's part of it. But a couple of weeks ago, my wife, Linnea, and I were in the car, and she was looking on her news feed, and she came across a story about a professor who said he proudly uses heroin. And it definitely caught my attention. The beginning of Pisces season, Pisces, you know, having a lot to do with altered states, I said, we got to get him on the podcast. And, you know, it's always that one of my favorite moments is that moment where I have an idea about a guest and then I get their birth information and I plug it in and I see what the chart says. And of course, there's no surprise. So Dr. Hart is a Scorpio. And Scorpios are really about getting to the bottom of what I call the stinky, dirty, nasty truth. You know, those truths that we all need to hear, but most of us are afraid to hear them. And so a lot of times Scorpio is associated with psychology, you know, understanding what motivates us from underneath. And he is a professor of psychology. Interesting though, drugs, right? And so the symbolism for altered states and drugs in a chart, we've talked about this before, are Neptune and Pisces. And so I looked at the chart to see, okay, what are Neptune and Pisces doing? Dr. Hart is a Pisces rising, you know, wearing the mask of the mystic. And he's got the planet Neptune in conjunction or actually in opposition to his moon. So his heart, the heart of a mystic, right? So these are really big themes that that jumped out in his chart. And his moon, right, the other part of the primal triad, is in the sign of Taurus, okay? So earthly. And reading his book, I noticed that he speaks a lot about music, right? Moon in Taurus, connected to Neptune, transcendence through music. So I will definitely ask him about that. And really, you know, the way I've been thinking about astrology lately, I started a workshop on teaching people how to think astrologically. And so the work of how do I break down this big, vast, abstract subject into pieces that people can not only understand, but that they can use in their daily lives. And one of the things I've come up with is really whittling down all the astrological symbols to 12 basic principles, okay? And so in Dr. Hart's chart, the two basic principles, one, Neptune, Pisces, in the 12th house is the archetypal field, the symbols. And that's transcendence, okay? Transcendence. And on the positive side, we all need to transcend. We all need to let go of our earthly concerns sometimes and receive inspiration. Otherwise, life can beat us up, okay? So if we have not enough transcendence, life feels too difficult. If we have too much transcendence, we escape, you know, all the negative things about addiction, an addiction to sex, TV, whatever, anything we do to escape, to avoid our life too much, okay? That's too much transcendence, right? So the other principle in Dr. Hart's chart is Pluto, Scorpio in the 8th house. And his son is in Scorpio in the 8th house, right? And so this is about deep healing. You know, this principle is really about deep healing, and the deep healing that comes from sitting with difficult truths. You know, there's something in the healing profession that we talk about a lot, is that in order to heal your pain, you have to feel your pain. And Scorpio points to those pains that are exceptionally hard to feel, because they're taboo, because we've been trained, we've been taught we're not supposed to feel those things. And so my guess is in this interview, both of these principles, these cosmic principles, are going to be evident when we talk to Dr. Hart. Because, you know, what I told people in the workshop is these principles apply to everything in life. These 12 cosmic principles or archetypes are what everything in the world are, the energy, everything in the world is created from these energies. And so you can experience them in people, but you can also experience them in situations, right? Or days, right? There's some transcendent or Neptunian days, right? Those days where you're drinking a lot, maybe you're smoking a lot, or you're watching a lot of TV, you're daydreaming, right? And in our culture, we tend to label those as negative days. But without those days, right, You know, I think life would lose the juice. Life would lose the meaning. So I'm excited to talk to Dr. Hart and see how these principles are manifesting and showing up in his life. So let's get to it. So welcome, Dr. Carl Hart, professor of neuroscience and psychology from Columbia University. Just a little welcome to Curious Questions with me, Ricky Williams. So the nature of the show is about almost 20 years ago, I really got into astrology, started studying astrology, and it really helped me understand myself and start to make sense of the world around me. And so what I do is I find people that are interesting to me. I bring them on the show, get their birth chart, look at the chart, and I kind of see, okay, what in this chart really piques my curiosity or interests me? And then I use that information to inform me to the questions that I ask, and hopefully leads to a more interesting interview.
Right on.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do you think about that idea?
Yeah, man, whatever you do, I dig it. I'm with it. So let's do it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, do you have any experience with astrology at all?
Well, you know, I'm black. I grew up in the 70s. We all kind of ask people what your sign is. That's about the extent of it.
Yeah.
So, and I know I'm a Scorpio, but that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, what's exciting to me is, I saw an article, my wife and I were in the car and we saw an article about you, and the kind of the headline caught our attention, you know, a professor who, you know, proudly uses heroin, you know, and a line about, you know, a couple of lines by the fireplace. And you know, it caught my attention and the idea of altered states of consciousness. And it was the first day of Pisces when I saw this article, and I thought it would be great to have him on the podcast. And really, you know, I'm extremely curious because a lot of parallels in my life, not as intense, but a lot of parallels in my life. And so I wanted to ask you questions. And then when I got your birth information, looked at your chart, I was like, whoa. And it's often like this, whoa. And, you know you're a Scorpio, and you know, that speaks to an interest in psychology, an interest in getting to the bottom of things, an interest in dealing with taboo subjects, all right, that generally speaking. And then your rising sign, which is another important symbol in astrology, is Pisces. And that's where I was like, okay, Pisces. Pisces is... it's about transcendence. You know, it's the archetype of the mystic. And the planet that's associated with the archetype of the mystic is Neptune. Okay. And when you were born, Neptune was opposing your moon. Okay. And so just like the chart just screamed really two basic themes, right? One theme is it's a theme of transcendence, spirituality, meditation, prayer, drugs. Okay. These are all in this archetypal field. And the other one, Scorpionic, is about facing difficult truth. You know, I mentioned dealing with the taboo. It's about facing difficult truths. And they're both considered water symbolism in astrology. And water symbolism has a lot to do with healing, recovery, regeneration. You know, tapping into, before you can heal your pain, you actually have to feel your pain. And so, you know, when there's these energies in someone's chart like yours that are so strong, usually there's things that happen to us very early in life that start us on this kind of path. And so I'm curious, what were your early experiences with spirituality?
I grew up Black American in the United States, born in the 60s, growing up in the 70s in Miami. You play with the Dolphins, you know something about Miami, maybe. Being Black in America and race and how racism plays out in America, if you are paying attention, obviously all of that shapes you. And then growing up in the Black church, how the race plays a role and shapes us. And so it's a lot to think about, a lot to handle, how it all comes together. I wrote a book, High Price, the first one, kind of deal with that sort of thing. And now this one here, Drug Use for Grownups, still struggling with all this sort of stuff, even to this day, because in the United States, we don't face issues honestly, and we don't face issues like adults. Instead, we do this adolescent bullshit. And I'm trying to have an adult conversation about these things. And so people, in having these conversations, you have to face yourself. You have to look at who you are. And sometimes that's uncomfortable. And so I try to share this kind of the uncomfortable things as well as the comfortable things with the public about me, and hoping that we could all have this conversation. And this book, Drug Use for Grownups, deals with people. They take drugs for a number of reasons, and partly some take it in order to be more spiritual. Others take them for other reasons, but I don't really know if we're even talking about the same things when people think about spirituality. Somebody might think about it differently. They use different language, but ultimately, we're all just trying to live the best lives we can and be the best people we can without causing others too much harm, too much stress. And some of us think of it as spirituality. Some of us think of it in other ways, but ultimately, I'm just trying to be the most honest person I can be. If that includes talking about race, drugs, all these taboo subjects, let's do it.
Okay. So, I mean, in you know, something interesting, you know, you mentioned being African-American growing up in the U.S. And, you know, that adds a whole nother level of taboo, you know, adds a whole nother level of taboo. And I remember I went back to university after I finished playing in the NFL, and I got really into school, and I joined this program called McNair Scholars that prepares people for a life in academia. And we were sitting in class one day, and we started talking about the idea of academic freedom. You know, that especially if you get tenure at a university, essentially, you know, you become an expert and you can say whatever you like. And it seems like, you know, because of your dedication, your hard work, and your success in academia, that you've reached a place where you can really pretty much on this topic say whatever you like.
Oh, man, that's a great observation. You know, tenure is supposed to be for this sort of academic freedom where you can say things that may be unpopular but consistent with the evidence, and so you are forced to say them. There are a lot of people who have tenure, who are tenured, and they are afraid. They are cowards, in part because if we think about like what recently happened to me, there are places like the New York Post, these tabloids, and they bastardize or they just simply lie about what I said or what I think. And then so now you get this wave of criticism. I mean, you had this wave of criticism when you left the NFL. People, they don't know the story, but that doesn't stop them from speaking on it. And that's the same thing here. And so people in the academy, whether they're tenured or not, they don't want that criticism. They are afraid. But frankly, man, I have children and I have to leave this world to them when I'm no longer here. And I don't want my children ever thinking, damn, my dad didn't call it like he saw it, or I'm catching this hell because the past generations didn't call it like it is. And so I don't want my children ever thinking of their father in that way. So I fear what they think of me far more than what the public or these other people think of me. And so I'm trying to be honest as I can to my science, to my profession. And so that's all we can do. And I make mistakes. So I want to make it clear that I'm a work in progress. And this is not some sort of static progress like growing up. It's one of these things that, you know, it's dynamic. You continue day after day. Some days you do better than others, and that's just how I'm trying to live.
Yeah. So you talked about, you know, honesty. When did this honesty become directed towards drugs?
Well, I've been studying drugs for about 30 years, and I started studying drugs because growing up in the hood, you were told that drugs were the reason that the community was not doing well. I remember the whole crack era. People blamed crack for high unemployment rates, for crime, and all of these sorts of things. And So I started studying drugs because I thought, like, well, if I learned something about how drugs affect the brain, then I can maybe fix drug addiction, therefore fix the problems in my community. After 30 years of study, I learned that, oh, that's wrong. Drugs were not the cause of those problems. Those problems were there long before crack got there. But yet, crack became the convenient scapegoat. And so as I learned more and more information, I started to be more confident to call people out on the nonsense. But that took a long time. That's a long development. I'm happy with the process. I'm happy that people are starting to question. I mean, people know with cannabis, for example, they know we've been lied to. I mean, we banned cannabis in 1937 in the United States, primarily not because of pharmacology, but because of our American racism. We associated cannabis use and heinous acts with Black people, with Mexican people. That led to the banning of cannabis, even though those acts were exaggerated and they weren't true. People lied. So we lied about cannabis and we banned it. We banned cannabis because of that. We now know that we were lied to about cannabis, but what we don't know as well is that we were lied to about cocaine. We were lied to about heroin. We were lied to about all of these drugs. So people can see the cannabis story, but they can't see the other drug stories as well. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to help people to see that, look, if you've been lied to here, why wouldn't you have been lied to here as well?
So, I mean, a couple of things. I think first, you know, when you talk about lied to, you know, I was part of the generation that grew up in the 80s and Just Say No, Dare. And there was, you know, a whole campaign to create a certain narrative around drugs. And so to speak up against that now is extremely, extremely taboo, extremely taboo. And I think the history and the information is a big part of it. I think the more informed we are of our history, you know, we can be more objective and make better choices. But I'm more interested in the personal journey of all of us that have been lied to and waking up to those lies. You know, in your book, you mentioned listening to James Baldwin speak about drugs. And when you first heard him, you thought he was incorrect. And then reflecting back, you realize that we've all been indoctrinated to believe this story. And so what was your process like of waking up and letting go of that indoctrination, that training?
It was a gradual process. So I can think about like James Baldwin's words. He spoke those words in 1986, December 1986. James Baldwin argued that all drugs should be legally regulated, because he argued that the drug laws, as people were proposing them, they could only be used against the poor. That's what he was arguing. He was arguing that these drug laws would exacerbate racial discrimination and all the rest of these things. And at the time, we were concerned about crack. And so I believed the hype like everybody else. I believed the public service announcements from people like Pee Wee Herman, who said, you know, like taking crack is like putting a gun in your mouth and pulling the trigger. I believed that nonsense at the time. But then as I got more involved in education, I read more, I learned more from my own studies, I started to see inconsistencies. For example, we said that crack was so addictive, you were addicted after one hit. We said the same thing about heroin. We said the same thing about a number of drugs. But then when you look at the numbers, the vast majority of users of any drug are not addicted. Only about 5 to 30% of the people who use those drugs, from heroin to cocaine to methamphetamine, they will become addicted. Only 5 to 30%. I mean, that 30%, that's still, whether it's 5% or 2%, is still, we should still be concerned about it. So I want to make it clear that people, to people, that I understand that. But what is important here for me at the time was that those numbers told me that the vast majority of users of any drug never become addicted. That was inconsistent with the story that I was told. Other things that were inconsistent. We bring people into the lab at places like Columbia and we give them these drugs and we test the effects of crack cocaine, a methamphetamine, a marijuana, a wide range of drugs. We test the effects on people and the predominant effects are positive. Mm. The folks who we bring into the lab for these studies, they are decent, responsible, good human beings. All of that's inconsistent with what we've been telling people about the users of these drugs. So over time, these inconsistencies caused me a lot of cognitive dissonance, and I had to resolve this dissonance. And one way to resolve the dissonance is to shift your thinking. And so that's what happened to me gradually. And not to mention the fact that I had cousins, friends, other relatives who were arrested for simply having a drug on them, for simply putting something in their body as they chose. And also knowing something about the Declaration of Independence, the founding document of the country, the document that guarantees all of us life, liberty, and the right and the pursuit of happiness. As long as you are not bothering other people or disrupting their ability to do the same, that's guaranteed to each of us as citizens of the United States. And in that same document, it says that the government should be created to secure those rights, not restrict them. And so learning all of this sort of stuff and seeing all the people we're arresting for what they put in their bodies, I realized that I was dumb. I wasn't really educated if I didn't stand up on behalf of the people who were being persecuted, who were being treated in an inconsistent manner with the promise of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And so all of this occurred over a period of time, over a 30 year period. And so I put all of this in a new book, Drug Use for Grownups, to try to help Americans understand what it really means to be an American. Not putting up some flag or wearing some flag on your lapel, on your jacket. That's not what it means. What it means is that you respect the rights of others and you fight for the rights of others and you are guaranteed these rights. That's what it means to be an American.
So, I mean, hearing you talk about this, this feels very, very, very personal. It feels very personal to you. So I'm curious, when did your academic research start to intermingle with your own personal research with drugs?
Well, as scientists, most scientists study issues or topics that are very personal to them. Many of us, we try to be as objective as possible. But when people start telling you that they're just completely objective and they don't have any personal connections, then you can stop listening because that person is probably lying to you. And so it has always, the topic of drugs and studying drugs has always been personal because growing up, as I pointed out, we were told that drugs were destroying our community. And so it became very personal. And then as I got older, the effects of drugs are predominantly positive. People are seeking effects like empathy, effects like openness, forgiveness, all of these kinds. These are good effects. These are effects that we want to encourage in our population. And so if people are seeking these effects, why are we vilifying people? And so, yeah, it's deeply personal because what kind of person wants to prevent someone from experiencing pleasure and feeling good?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm getting goosebumps here because I feel like these conversations are conversations that need to be had more between more than one person having it with themselves. And I know this conversation is one I've had with myself over the past 15 years. And I mentioned earlier that, my story being parallel for me, a little bit different. I was using cannabis because it made me feel good, but I was a little confused because I was still buying into the old story of, okay, this is supposed to be bad for me. And there, you know, there's big punishment if I get caught doing this. And so I ended up getting caught and decided, you know, instead of playing this game, I'm going to live my life. And one of the things that really haunted me was really trying to understand, is what I was told about cannabis true, or is there more to the story? And as I started traveling around the world and doing my own research, I started to realize what you pointed out earlier, that I was lied to. And it allowed me to do my own healing, where I started to let go of that old narrative of, okay, I'm a bad person or I shouldn't be doing this. And it allowed me, I think more importantly, to receive more of the positive effects, compassion, forgiveness, because at the root of my cannabis use, that was always the root of it from the very beginning, you know? And I think we're taught to feel ashamed about that. And I think that's a travesty. The next question I want to ask is so your research is in studying the effect of drugs on people. And from your research, what have you seen as far as the highest potentials for how people have used drugs in their life, and also on the other end of the spectrum, some of the dark side and the lowest potentials?
Well, you know, it's important that people understand that drug effects are not determined solely by the pharmacology or just the drug itself. It's important to think about the environment, the person, sort of a maturity level. All of these sort of things play an important role, whether you're taking a drug that's banned, cannabis in all states except 15, whether you're taking it in a place where it's banned, or whether you're taking it in another country where they don't get crazy about enforcing drug laws, all of those things impact the effects that you will see. And so I have seen people who take heroin on a daily basis. In Switzerland, for example, I worked in a clinic for a little bit where they gave heroin twice a day, every day, and seen some of the happiest people, most of all people you ever want to meet, were those folks who were coming to the clinic to get heroin twice a day. By that same token, you put that same drug in the mix in the U.S. where you make sure that persons don't have any sort of material resources. You make sure that the people have been degraded for much of their lives, and then you put a drug like heroin in the mix, and then you blame heroin for all the problems that you're going to see. And so it's really important to think about the people. So like when you think about the Ivy League, or you think about other institutions, higher level institutions, people have been using drugs since time began, and no problems. They helped them to achieve certain things. Certain goals help them to be better people in some cases, and not a problem. But you can also see other behavior. You can see people behave in a way where they're jerks. So you just think about alcohol in that respect. There are some people who were jerks before they took alcohol, but then you give them a drink, guess what? They're still a jerk, and they're still going to be not nice people. The same is true with cannabis. The same is true with heroin. The same is true with cocaine. And so one of the things I'm trying to help people to understand is that drug effects has less to do with the drug itself and more to do with all of these other things. The dose, the environment in which it's taken, the level, the skill set of the person taking the drug, wide range of issues. And so it's hard to really say that so one drug is this versus that. I know people like to do that, but I worry about what we call exceptionalism, where we say our drug is better than your drug, and then we just do the same thing in terms of discriminate against these people who use that drug because they're not like us. And so that's why I really worry about that.
Huh, this is interesting. I mean, what I'm hearing you say is the research done, I think, in the 60s with Outport around LSD was they learned that set and setting and using psychedelics was extremely important. But I hadn't considered set and setting in terms of socioeconomic milieu. And that's real. That's real. And so I'll just ask you straight up. So what would you say is the main difference between people using drugs responsibly and using drugs irresponsibly?
Oh, you could, when you think about people who use drugs responsibly versus irresponsibly, let's just think about adolescence. I'll just use myself. When I was 18 or so or 19, I was serving in the Air Force over in England, and we drank heavily. And I screwed up a lot drinking as an adolescent in the military there. I would never do those things today as a 54-year-old man that I did when I was 19. So you can consider some of my drug use, alcohol use at that time, really irresponsible. But now as a 54-year-old man with all these responsibilities, I don't indulge too much. I make sure that I'm okay for the next day's activity or whatever. And so the same is true with cocaine. The same is true with heroin. The same is true with cannabis. Oftentimes, you know, you hear people say, oh, this when I was young, I did this drug. I'll never do that again. It's like, how old were you when you had that problem? Oh, I was 20. I was 19. How old are you now? Oh, I'm 50-something. And you think you're going to still behave like you did when you were 20? That's ridiculous. But people have this sort of notion. And then when you call it ridiculous, then they say, well, you know, I have this problem. And if I have a one hit, it's all over. And so you don't want to be insensitive, but I try to bring some reality to the situation so that people understand that none of us, I hope, are like you were when you were 20 and now that you're 50. Because if you are, that means you didn't grow. You didn't learn much throughout life. We make these mistakes as young people in order to make sure that we are better and we're teaching future generations. But making mistakes, that's humans, and that's okay.
Yeah, and it seems like with drugs and with altered states, you know, if we allow ourselves to, you know, have experiences with them, that allows us to mature in the way that we use them. But if we make it taboo and we have to be secretive or we have to hide when we use them, it makes that maturity process actually quite difficult.
Absolutely. And it pushes the activity underground. It pushes us off into the shadows where you're more likely to have negative effects because you don't have people there saying, no, you don't do it like that. You do it like this. No, this is the best way to do that. This is what you can expect. And if you have trouble, you're not ashamed of saying, hey, I'm having a bad time. I'm having a bad time. I need help. You're not ashamed because people are not stigmatizing you. And so that's one of the goals of the new book, too, is to try to destigmatize this activity such that people are not afraid to reach out for help.
And so after reading this book, where do people go? You know, do you foresee one day there'll be YouTube videos showing people how to use heroin?
I don't think we need YouTube videos to show people how to use heroin. You know, people use heroin just like they use a variety of drugs like cocaine. They snort it, some smoke it, some inject it. So people kind of know those kind of things. The problem that we have as a result of our punitive drug laws is that when people think they have heroin, they may not have heroin. They have some other substance, something like a fentanyl compound or something even more potentially dangerous. And so that's where a lot of the problems lie. The problems also lie in the sort of varied potency of the drug. So if you only have 5% of heroin when you should have 100% of heroin, you know, people might be more likely to inject it. And when you are injecting drugs with not clean equipment, you run the risk of having blood-borne illnesses. You run the risk of having all kinds of problems that you wouldn't have if you had like a pure sort of substance, and people wouldn't really have to inject. And so many of the problems that we see are related to our punitive laws and not the drugs themselves.
So it's interesting. So, you know, as I'm hearing you speak, I can hear, you know, more conservative people if there are any conservative people listening, I can hear more conservative people thinking, well, you know, with all of that, why even deal with it? You know, and related to that idea is most of the discourse on drugs have been why they're bad, why they're bad. And so even when we start talking about it, it's like we're trying to discount why they're not bad. But there aren't very many conversations about what can they actually be used for in a positive sense. And to me, that's more interesting.
Absolutely. That's far more interesting because whether we like it or not, whether you and I like it or not, or anyone, people are going to seek the effects of these drugs, in part because these effects are so humane-like. They help people to feel better, to feel euphoric, to feel pleasure. These are all good things. As humans seek these sorts of things. We seek them through sexual activity and all the rest of these things. So the notion that we shouldn't talk about the good things, it's like censoring our sort of ideas. That's some silly shit. I don't want to live in a place where you can't talk about the range of things. And in this conversation, and talking about the range of things is in the service of keeping people healthy, safe, and it's also in the service of living up to the principles, to the promise of the founding document of the country. And so when I think about conservatives or anybody else, it's like, well, if you're really American, then you would be involved in this conversation too, because you want to make sure that we live up to our ideals, live up to our promise, because we are fond of saying that America is the freest country on the planet. Haven't been no damn where people say that kind of thing and not understanding that we are not. We are, particularly when it comes to drugs, we are puritanical and we are hyper-judgmental of other people. And that's not freedom.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you mentioned this idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So, you know, after I got in trouble with the NFL, I came back to the NFL and I went back to college, went back to school. And I was sitting in a psychology class and we got to a chapter where we were talking about this. And I was reading these words and I had a tear come down my eye because of all the suffering that I went through when all I was doing was something that is supposed to be promised to us. And I had a really emotional moment. And you know, I hear you and I agree with you. And I think the big part of the conversation is how do we move, you know, what you're calling drug effects, how do we move them out of the taboo area and move them into the light and realize that this is, like you said, this is a part of being humane, you know, is that we all need in some way, you know, a way to transcend, a way to receive inspiration, a way to disconnect. You know, a way to let go of heaviness, you know, that it's a real part of life.
Yeah, that's why I wrote the book, to have this conversation, to also offer tips to people, to show people their view of a typical drug user, whatever that is probably doesn't comport with reality. And I also ask people to get out of the closet about their drug use, particularly respectable, responsible people. And so folks would be less likely, for example, to vilify you for doing something as like you're an aberration, when in fact we know other people are doing the same thing. But they're in the closet and they are respectable people. But as long as they stay in the closet and not stand up for these American ideals, it allows individuals to be persecuted. And so if you sit in a closet while other people are being persecuted, and then you hold as your sort of heroes, people like Rosa Parks or Martin Luther King, then you're not living up to what those people actually did. They stood up. They stood up for other people. They stood up on behalf of other people. And if you're in the closet, then you're not standing up to the ideals of the LGBT community because they had to get out of the closet and they stood up for their rights just to be human. They're not bothering anyone. They're just enjoying the rights guaranteed in the Declaration of Independence. Some people say, well, the Declaration wasn't for us. When they wrote the Declaration, it wasn't for us. It was only for a select group of white men, as if that discounts the principles that were espoused. It doesn't. We know, for example, Thomas Jefferson owned Africans as slaves, and which is abhorrent, and we know that. And he was an abhorrent person for that. But it doesn't discount the words that were written. He probably plagiarized those words from John Locke, but it doesn't really matter. Those principles still apply because we believe that people have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So it doesn't matter who said it. It is enshrined in our founding document. And so it means it's for all of us now. And so it's up to us to ensure that we deliver on that promise to all of our citizens.
All right. So you mentioned coming out of the closet, and that's something again that you and I share. I came out both coming out of the closet about drug use when it wasn't popular. And so what advice can you give to people who are in the closet and starting to think about, you know, maybe becoming more public with their drug use?
Yeah, you know, you could come out of the closet in a variety of ways. I'm not asking people to, because I know there are some states that will, for example, take away your children if you've been identified as a drug user, and that's a heavy thing. I'm not asking people to do that. But there are different ways in which people can come out of the closet. You can come out to your small circle of close family members, friends. You don't have to do it in this big way initially. But we need people to start to challenge this caricatured view of what a drug user look like. And we need people to challenge this view because too often folks have been allowed to use drugs to scapegoat bad behavior. Police brutality is one of those kind of behaviors that drugs have been used to scapegoat. I'm thinking about George Floyd now. There's a trial that's getting ready to go on.
Trayvon
Martin, Mike Brown, think about all of these folks. Drugs were blamed. Their drug use was said to have been the reasons for their death. Even though we see videotapes and we see what is actually happening, but people are telling us, don't believe your lying eyes, believe me. And that's just, and so if we come out of the closet, then we change this narrative. People say, no, that didn't happen. I know that's not true. And people came out of the closet with cannabis now. And so now we are having more liberalized cannabis laws. And I think we should do the same thing with other drugs as well.
Yeah. All right. So, to end this conversation, I want to get a little personal. So, in your astrology chart, the moon, which rules our heart, how we nurture ourselves, it's really about our inner life. Okay. And your moon is in the sign of Taurus, right? And Taurus is an earth sign, and it's very much associated with peace of mind. And in that vein, music, right? And reading your book, I also love music, but I just want to hear you talk about music and how it can be transcendent. By the way, I want to say my wife and I, we watched the YouTube video of Al Green on Soul Train, and it was transcendent.
My God, you just hit it on the head, man. Music is, as you noted throughout the book, there is a soundtrack. Whenever I write, there's a soundtrack in my head. There's music going on in the background, and much of the music is 1970s soul music, a lot of that music. You talked about Al Green, that particular song, Jesus is Waiting. It kind of takes me back to growing up, like the Black Church and those sort of things. And Al Green's performance on Jesus is Waiting on that day on Soul Train, he had transcended that place. He was not there. That performance was a performance like I have never seen before. And so when I'm in my space and I am psychoactively altered as I choose or see fit with my wife or whatever, there's always music because the music and the artist, they really helped me to feel more human. They really helped me to feel more connected to other humans, and they helped me to examine my own behavior and the impact of my behavior on other people, particularly if it's negative. And then so I have to reevaluate, and I have to clean up that behavior, and I have to be cognizant if my behavior is negatively impacting other people. That horrifies me, particularly if people are more junior to me and my behavior caused them to have some negative interactions with their loved one. And so music in that setting and always gets me to thinking about how to be a better person, how to be a better human, how to treat people better, and how to be more open. The music of the soul music of the 70s, particularly people like Al Green, kind of transports me back to that place and into that space where I'm seeking to be better.
Yeah, I mean, what you're talking about, it feels like the definition of spiritual, in the sense of where we have that experience of we're not separate, that if I'm doing harm to you, I'm doing harm to myself. The last thing I want to talk about is, you just mentioned it, and you mentioned it a lot in your book, your wife, and this idea of in your chart, it shows that relationship and deep relationship and this deep kind of transformative healing that can occur in relationships. Can you talk about, because I think it's rare, you know, reading the book, I have something similar with my wife, but it's rare to find that person where you can go to those places and they're willing to go with you. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. You know, when I think about my wife's relationship and mine, it's not like something that happened overnight. We've been together since 92, and Lord knows we have had some rocky times, and we have had some knockdown, drag out sort of arguments and whatever. And that kind of makes it all rich, because we grow up, and we grew up, and we're still growing up. And so I think it's important for people to understand that it ain't something that is a smooth setting or something like a day at the beach. It doesn't work that way. That shit requires work. And so in part, it's lovely being more than 50 together, because we kind of have seen some things. And things like when we were 20 or 30 or younger, we didn't understand as well. And we didn't know how to handle as well. It really, that's where I actually learned how to be, that's how I actually learned how to take other people's feelings into consideration, because I think I was a son of a bitch, to be honest with you, for a long time. And so I don't want to give the impression that I am, evolved.
But that is the impression. And if you're not going to give it, I'm going to give it, because the truth is, evolution comes through those knockdown drag, right? If you don't get to the bottom of the stuff stays there at the bottom, kind of running your life. And so to me, this is the real conversation of the way you become a better person is you got to get to the stuff. And I think it's so important to find a partner that's not going to run away or point fingers when the stuff comes up, and I found in my relationship, that cannabis, ayahuasca, it has facilitated us, given us perspective after those, knockdown drag outs.
Thank you. you said it better than me, man. That's it, man. That's absolutely it. Because, MDMA is really good in that setting. 6-APB, people might not know that one as much, but they're excellent in that setting. Kind of melts away all the negative, petty little stuff that you hold in, and you deal with what's really important.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's wonderful. And like I said, I think there needs to be more conversations like this, grown-ups talking about drugs. Thank you for joining me. And I'm sure we'll bump into each other again.
Thank you very much, man. It's so nice to meet you. And I'm really happy you're doing your thing because, you know, you were a hero of mine, still is. And so just know that.
Yeah. And, you know, you're my hero. You know, I have aspirations in academia and just value knowledge, especially knowledge, you know, things that are important to us, right? Studying the things and telling our story, allowing our voice and our perspective to be heard. So thank you.
Well, if you ever want to come to Columbia, you are welcome.
I mean, honestly, I was in McNair. It's one of the schools I was taking a serious look at. Yeah.
Well, we would be happy to have you as an honorary lab member or any capacity you like.
I appreciate that. This is awesome. Thank you, Dr. Hart.
Thank you.
What an amazing interview. I don't ever know how these are going to go, but I knew this one would be fascinating. And, you know, I started off talking about, you know, spirituality and trying to open up there. But, you know, but quickly Dr. Hart got into his book. And I can understand why. Spirituality is kind of a vast, complex subject. And people have a lot of different opinions about it. And I can see how sometimes it can confuse the argument around altered states. But aside from the word spirituality, when he described how he uses altered states and what the upside of using drugs were, they were all spiritual words, all Neptunian, Piscean words. And so it's there. And, you know, I feel like towards the end of the interview, the conversation got more strongly in the area of talking about how can we use substances in a way to enhance our lives and really moving out of the conversation of, is this good? Is this bad? Is this good? Is this bad? Because what I've learned is whether something is good or bad depends on how you use it. And personally, for me, I think the bigger issue, and it's definitely tied to race, but the bigger issue is the taboo against altered states of consciousness as something that's that can be life affirming. I mean, obviously, everything can be abused. And there's, you know, if you escape from your life, there's big consequences. And so it's, you know, it's important to be cognizant of that. But I think more importantly, and I think what we got to in that conversation is the need to have adult conversations about all taboo subjects. But I think right now, specifically about altered states and about drugs. So again, I think this is probably one of my favorite episodes. Speaking to an elder, you know, someone who's been through their own experiences, and in this case, spent years researching and studying the topic, and not afraid to share his wisdom, even the taboo wisdom. So very grateful to Dr. Hart for sharing that wisdom. Thank you guys for checking me out again and listening. You know, thinking about what I hope listeners are getting out of this episode. It's really to realize all the places in our lives that we've been lied to. And, you know, we're still trying to make those lies right, which usually means that we're making ourselves wrong. And so a lot of Scorpio Pluto is about the difficult work of getting in touch with the pain. Okay. Because if you don't feel your pain, you can't heal your pain. Okay. So the Scorpio work is getting to the bottom of it, getting to the pain, okay? But then don't get stuck when you're there, right? And this is where Pisces Neptune comes in, right? When I grew up in church, we'd say, give it on up to Jesus or whoever. But this idea, if we're connected to some greater whole, whether you call it nature or the universe or spirit or God or whatever, we can transcend and transform our darkest places and use that energy to become our best selves, right? And so an affirmation kind of question what lies are you using to keep yourself in a constant state of judgment of yourself? And that's the Scorpio stuff, eighth house, Pluto. And for the transcendent part is, you know, simple one, is what can you let go of that you're holding on to too tightly, that you really don't need, right? And if you combine the questions, right, look at all the hurt, pain, humiliation, all of the negative stuff, dark stuff that you're holding on to, that you might feel better and do better if you're willing to let go of. And then when you let go of it that way, I think it puts you in a place where you don't have to escape using altered states. You can actually move towards wholeness and oneness, which to me is what these substances can offer us. You can watch, listen to this episode on Spotify, iTunes, and YouTube. And if you like it, only if you like it, and if you really like it, subscribe. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.